They had been traveling for just over half an hour when Bolin picked up the sound of the helicopter. It was coming from the northeast. The sound rose and fell, finally becoming a steady beat that grew louder. The soldier moved in the general direction the aircraft was flying. The forest had thinned out, and Bolin made for a generous clearing where the open ground would expose him. He pulled Randolph into the shadow of a wide tree trunk at the edge of the clearing.
"Don't move from here until I call for you. Understand, Randolph?"
The boy nodded. He stared at Bolin.
"Are these bad men?"
"Yes."
"You're not going away?"
"No, I'm not going away."
The boy slid to the ground and pulled himself close to the tree. Bolin edged away, breaking into the open. He caught a glimpse of the helicopter as it came into sight. It was moving back and forth in a grid pattern, checking each section of ground as it flew over. Bolin moved into the open, crossing the clearing at a steady pace. The helicopter passed overhead, still short of the clearing. Bolin watched it fly beyond his position. The turbine sound began to fade. He turned to cross the clearing again. He reached midway when the helicopter swept back over the tops of the trees and yawed violently as the pilot worked the controls. The helicopter, a French Puma, dipped suddenly, angling in across the clearing. Bolin turned and ran, leading the aircraft. He heard the sudden hammer of a heavy machine gun. The thump of bullets hitting the ground was uncomfortably close. Bolin veered to the right, doubling back. Gouts of earth flew into the air around him. He took a dive that ended in a shoulder roll, bringing him into a sitting position. Bolin pulled the Uzi into firing position and tracked the Puma as it swept toward him, coming round so that the door gunner could locate his target. Bolin had the gunner in his sights before the Puma settled, hovering no more than 10 feet above. He touched the trigger and laid a burst into the door gunner's upper chest. The gunner grunted under the impact, falling back to hang by his safety harness, the machine gun swinging free on its rack. The Puma rose, hanging 20 feet up. Bolin, on his feet, moved around so he could stay underneath the machine, out of sight. The rotor wash pushed at him, flattening the stalks of grass in the clearing.
"Where is he? Where is that bastard?"
"Staying out of sight."
Campos had taken down an SA-80 from one of the weapon racks. He clicked in a magazine.
"Simon, he's taken care of the door gunner. Now he's waiting for us to do something."
Chakra unclipped his seat harness and pushed his way to the main cabin. He freed the dead gunner from the safety harness and took control of the machine gun.
"Then let's not disappoint him. Get us down!"
he yelled at the pilot.
"A few feet off the ground."
The Puma began to sink. Chakra gripped one of the safety straps, leaning out to check the ground as the Puma began to descend. He had changed from the machine gun to the pistol in the holster on his hip. He swept the area with a muzzle as he searched for the man known as Belasco. On the opposite side of the cabin, Hector Campos was checking his patch of ground. He watched the rippling grass flattened to the earth by the downdraft from the rotors. The Cuban saw nothing. He was about to say so to Chakra when the thought struck him. The American hadn't been seen running for cover, moving away from the Puma, so if he hadn't vacated the area...
"He's under the damn helicopter!"
Chakra turned.
"What?"
Campos pointed at the floor of the cabin.
"Underneath! He's using the fucking helicopter as cover!"
"Land! Now! Put her down fast!"
Bolin saw the Puma settling, coming down on him faster than he might have expected. He turned and ran, clearing the underside of the fuselage in a dive that took him away from the helicopter's bulk. He turned over on his back, the Uzi already pushed out ahead of him, and caught sight of a lean, dark-haired figure in the open doorway. It was Hector Campos. The Cuban saw Bolin's black-clad figure flat on the ground with a 9mm Uzi tracking in on him. Bolin saw a rush of alarm sweep through Campos as he stared at the Uzi's black muzzle. Bolin pulled the Uzi online, finger hitting the trigger, then watched the solid thumps hit the body as 9mm slugs punched through his chest wall. The tearing sensation that followed must have denied Campos the chance to cry out. Bolin watched him stumbling back into the cabin, away from the open door as he fell. The moment he fired on Campos and saw him fall back from the open doorway, Bolin rolled to his feet. He reached the Puma in 3 long strides, taking a leap into the opening. As his feet hit the cabin floor, Bolin saw Simon Chakra swinging around on the far side of the cabin. The man had a safety strap looped around his left wrist and a hefty auto pistol in his right. He wore combat gear, with the rank of colonel pinned to the lapels. As Bolin caught his balance, Chakra leaned forward and swung a heavy boot and a vicious kick that caught Bolin on the right hip. The blow wrenched a gasp of pain from Bolin's lips.
"Ugh!"
Chakra lashed out with a pistol. Bolin felt it thud against the side of his head, over his left eye. Blood began to run from the ugly gash. Chakra swung his arm a second time. Bolin ducked under the swing and used the Uzi to deliver a blow of his own to the African's jaw. Chakra roared in pain. He slammed the butt of the pistol down between Bolin's shoulders as the executioner closed in. Bolin closed his mind to the pain, using his bulk to push Chakra backward. It was only when Chakra stepped into empty air with one foot that he realized his position. He swung the pistol again, catching Bolin's upthrust arm. Bolin leaned back, pulling the Uzi around so the muzzle was jammed hard against Chakra's body. Bolin pulled the trigger and put half the magazine through the man's lower chest. Chakra was swung aside under the impact of the 9mm slugs. He missed his footing completely and hung, suspended by his left wrist, outside the Puma. Bolin turned back inside the helicopter and moved up to cover the pilot and radio operator. They had become aware of the struggle taking place behind them, but it had been all over before either man could unstrap himself and reach the weapons rack. Now they were confronted by the sight of the tall, bloody American, his Uzi fixed on them and with a dangerous look in his eyes.
Hands where I can see them at all times.
He backed away and pulled the sheathed knife he carried. Reaching up, he severed the safety strap supporting Simon Chakra's lifeless body. Chakra fell to the ground and lay in a sodden sprawl. Bolin rolled the bodies of the dead gunner and Hector Campos out of the helicopter as well.
Randolph, let's go! You can come out now.
Bolin saw Karima's son emerge from his hiding place. The boy ran across to the helicopter and scrambled in, trying to avoid looking at the bodies sprawled on the ground.
Go and strap yourself into one of those seats.
Bolin closed the cabin doors, then eased himself into one of the seats fixed along the sides of the cabin, next to Randolph.
What happens now?
Bolin took the map he had carried for so long out of his pocket. He showed it to the pilot.
Get us into the area, then land.
The pilot glanced at the map, then across at the radio operator.
Hey, never mind him, pal. I'm the one who gives the orders now. You got any problems with that?
The pilot shook his head.
Then do it. Just a word. I understand compass points and I can read maps, so no diversions. This Uzi is loaded.
The pilot settled in his seat and powered the Puma's turbines. The helicopter rose into the air and swung around as the pilot set his new course. Bolin leaned his back against the bulkhead. He ached from head to foot. The gash on his head was still bleeding, and Chakra's gun butt had left him with a badly bruised back. He pulled the transceiver from his pocket and placed it on the next seat. Once they reached the general area, he would turn it on and see if he could locate the signal from the set he'd left with Catherine and Ashanti. Bolin glanced across at Randolph. The boy was asleep. Lucky kid, Bolin thought. Bolin could use some sleep too. Later. His mission wasn't over yet. Mac Bolin stood with Ashanti, Catherine Karima translating for him.
Are the slavers dead?
Yes.
Ashanti smiled.
Perhaps they will think before they come to Tampala again.
They paid a high price this time.
Bolin was facing the Puma helicopter. The pilot and the radio operator were on their knees, hands behind their heads, just in front of the machine. A pair of tempai stood over them, spears held ready if the men attempted anything. Ashanti looked across to where the other children, grouped together, were sitting.
We will care for them until they are returned home.
It may take a while, Ashanti.
Then we will care for them for a while. Don't worry, Belasco. They're with family now.
I have to go. To take Karima's children back to him.
I understand. Take care, Belasco.
Bolin moved toward the helicopter, Catherine and Randolph close behind him. He gestured with his Uzi and got the pilot and radio operator on their feet. They all boarded the Puma.
Set your course for Tampala City.
The Puma's turbines powered up, rotors starting to spin.
Can you get me to Government House?
Yes.
Then do it.
The helicopter lifted and surged forward, gaining altitude quickly. Bolin kept an eye on the pilot until he was sure the man had the Puma on the correct course. Behind Bolin, Karima's children settled close together for the flight. They looked tired and worn, their clothing torn and filthy. Apart from the superficial aspects, the pair seemed to have weathered their experience pretty well. There might be repercussions later as the full weight of the ordeal emerged. They had heard and seen grim things. Bolin hoped their youthful resilience would see them through the trauma. The radio operator caught Bolin's attention.
I'm having difficulty getting through. The frequencies are all busy or jammed.
Let's hear.
The operator channeled the radio through to the speaker. He ran through the frequencies, letting Bolin listen in. There was a lot of interference, voices running into each other.
This is the channel for the Government House Communication Center.
Nothing came from the speaker. Bolin's immediate thoughts were that something was happening in the city, and following on that thought came images of rebel activity. He hadn't forgotten the bomb explosion outside his hotel, the unexpected attack by the rebels, tied, he was certain, to the fact that Karima's kidnapped children had been lost to the rebels. Maybe they had decided to increase the pressure on Karima, especially since Bolin's intervention and his clashes with the rebel military forces. He sat back, telling the radio operator to close down. The pilot spoke up.
"So where do we go? Maybe those kids don't have a home to go back to."
Catherine made a soft sound in her throat as she heard the pilot's comment. She looked up at Bolin.
What does he mean? Has something bad happened at home?
Everything will work out, Catherine. I promise.
If there was rebel activity in the city, Bolin decided, then he had to stay away from Government House until he could make a full assessment of the situation. Bolin's problem was his lack of contacts within Tempala. He immediately deleted that thought from his mind. He had contacts. Ambassador Leland Cartwright and Phil McCready. Cartwright's team had their base within the U.S. Embassy. If he could get the helicopter to land inside the grounds, the kids would at least be safe there while he made his assessment. He turned to the children.
It's going to be okay.
The Puma's pilot decided to play his stubborn card at first, refusing to take the American to the embassy.
What are you going to do, Belasco? Kill me and let us crash?
You could have the first part right, pal. Didn't I mention I can fly one of these things myself? So if it comes to push and shove, you're a disposable asset. I let you fly so far because it suited my purpose. Think about it while you're watching for the city to show up.
The pilot fell silent while he worked out whether the man was telling the truth. The American had proved to be adept at everything else he had done. There was the possibility he was bluffing. The only way the pilot was going to prove that would put his own life at risk, and he had no intention of doing that. He realized his only course was to do as the American said.
We should be sighting the city in about 10 minutes.
Fine. Alter your course and bring us down inside the U.S. Embassy compound.
As the Puma touched down on the lawn fronting the embassy, armed Marines converged on it. They surrounded the helicopter, weapons ready. Bolin ordered the pilot and radio operator to the cabin and got them to open the side door. A Marine sergeant took charge.
Step out! Hands in sight!
Do it!
Bolin let the pilot and radio operator exit the Puma. Bolin brought the children out with him.
Sergeant, these are Joseph Karima's children. Can you inform Ambassador Cartwright that Mike Belasco has them safe? He knows about me. So does Phil McCready.
The Marine stared at Bolin's disheveled appearance. Filthy clothing and hard-dried blood on his face and head.
Sir, I don't know who the hell you are, but it's for sure you haven't been on a picnic.
Bolin smiled.
Sergeant, you said it. Now, what about Cartwright? I need to talk to him fast.
Sir, don't we all? I guess you haven't heard. Ambassador Cartwright was snatched last night.
Belasco?
Bolin glanced up at the familiar voice. He saw Phil McCready crossing the lawn. The man smiled when he saw Catherine and Randolph.
Jesus, you did it!
What's this about Cartwright?
McCready held up a hand. Let's get these kids inside. Then we'll talk. The Marines escorted the helicopter pilot and the radio operator toward the embassy building where they would be put under guard. The pilot spoke as he passed Bolin.
Was it true about you being able to fly the chopper?
Bolin looked him directly in the eyes.
What do you think?
Inside the embassy, Bolin followed McCready to an office. Once they were alone, McCready crossed to a steaming percolator and poured Bolin a mug of coffee. As they sat down facing each other across a large desk, McCready smiled nervously.
Leland's desk. Hell of a way to get to sit behind it.
While we were flying in, I spotted some smoke in areas of the city.
Rebels hit around midday. Power station, radio and TV studios. All key points. Apart from that, it's been a stalemate. Karima somehow managed to pull in a fair number of loyal troops, so the takeover has sort of come to a standoff.
Do you know where Cartwright is?
Rebel leaders have taken over Government House. They have Karima, Raymond and Koya, and now Cartwright.
Any threats?
They say they won't quit until Karima steps down, and Cartwright accepts that all U.S. interests are withdrawn from Tempala. We step back from the copper deal, and there's not going to be any U.S. military presence in the country.
Public reaction?
It's sparse, because the regular media outlets have been silenced. But the general feeling is the Tempalans, including a hell of a lot of the Karandi, have had enough. They don't want any more unrest. The bombing did the rebels a lot of harm.
But they still won't quit.
MacCready shook his head. The hardcore rebels still believe that if they get Karima out, the country will back them. To be honest, Mike, I really think they've blown their chance. Bolin drank his coffee. It seemed a lifetime since he'd had anything so good inside him.
Any chance of something to eat, Phil?
Sure, I'll fix it.
First a shower and a change of clothing. Then I need to talk to my people back home. We still have a communications link?
Yeah. We have our own power supply, so the rebels can't touch it. Satellite link as well.
Good.
Before this all happened, we heard about you identifying Chakra as being part of the rebel faction. How's he going to explain that away?
Posthumously.
Bolin had a direct line through to Stony Man. Seated in Leland Cartwright's leather chair, refreshed from a quick shower, a change of clothing, and having his wounds treated by the embassy doctor, Bolin completed his mission update for Hal Brignola.
Now that Chakra and Hector Campos are dead, and Karima's kids are safe, you'd expect that to be an end to it.
Not as long as Zimbala and Haruri have their hostages.
Barbara Price was also on the line.
We have confirmed reports of at least 20 dead, civilians included, Stryker.
What's a sitrep as far as Government House is concerned?
Small rebel force in control. Just sitting tight until Karima gives in.
With Leland Cartwright in the middle, how do we handle it?
You really want me to answer that?
No. And don't mention me by name.
Do I embarrass you, Hal?
I'm thinking.
How are the kids?
Tired, a little confused and scared. They don't understand why they still can't go home.
They must miss their father.
Yeah, well, that's something I'm going to put right.
MacCready had obtained floor plans for Government House. Bolin sat at Cartwright's desk, studying the drawings. It was helpful that Bolin had been inside the building. It allowed him a degree of familiarity with the layout. Even so, he was going in without full knowledge of the killing ground. It wasn't the way Bolin would have chosen to work, but the situation called for a fast insertion. The longer the rebels had their hostages, the more likely they might end up doing something out of sheer desperation if they realized matters were working against them. Bolin had no intention of letting that situation develop. At the rear of the building were cultivated gardens where civic functions took place. The garden area was walled off, and trees and shrubbery had been planted to add to the ambience. The rebels were reported to have both building and gardens under their control. The Tempala military, loyal to Karima, had taken up positions at the front of the Government House, and they had it under close scrutiny, with powerful spotlights trained on the building. Attempts to penetrate the rear of the building had been thwarted by a rebel sniper. Bolin went over the layout again, his concentration broken by a tap at the door.
Come in.
It was the Marine Sergeant. He was a career man in his mid-30s. Bolin had learned his name was Glenn McKay.
I have your ordnance, sir.
Bring it over.
He handed Bolin a folder that held a selection of photographs.
President Karima and Vice President Nkoya. I imagine you've met them?
Bolin nodded.
Okay. This is Leland Cartwright.
McKay held up a photo of a tall, gray-haired man sporting a tan that would have had George Hamilton jealous.
And this pair are Zimbala and Haruri, our rebel leaders.
Bolin studied the images, etching them into his memory. McKay was carrying a marine-issue bag in his hands. He placed it on a side table, opening the zipper.
I had my guys strip and clean your weapons.
He placed Bolin's Beretta and Desert Eagle on the table, along with their holsters. The Uzi came next.
I kind of took a fancy to that 93R. She as good as the manuals say?
Never let me down.
And I'll bet you've put that to the test a few times, huh?
Bolin inclined his head. McKay sensed the reluctance to take it any further, so he passed.
Half a dozen stun grenades.
He placed them on the table.
You said no frags?
Bolin nodded.
There could be friendlies in any given situation on this. I won't take the risk. Grenades have no conscience. They kill anyone who gets in their way.
McKay smiled. Never quite heard it said that way before, but I guess you're right. He placed Bolin's combat harness on the table, and then a combat suit of Marine issue. Yours was worse for wear, so we found you this. Hope you don't mind. Bolin picked up the clothing. The combat gear bore a dark night urban pattern that would be ideal for the situation they were going into.
I'd be proud to wear it, McKay.
You worked out your strategy?
This one is going to be strictly get up and go. No time for fancy planning and looking for the blind spots.
The way I like 'em, Belasco. Bolin glanced across at the Marine, confused. I'm coming with you. Remember, this is my bailiwick. If I let you go in on your own, my days on the Corps are numbered.
How about your superior and the ambassador?
McKay inclined his head. Let's just say they've developed a strain of what-I-don't-know-about-won't-hurt-me virus.
Welcome aboard, McKay. Let's get this show on the road.
It was coming up to late evening when Bolin and McKay parked up behind a darkened office building two blocks down from Government House. They had used one of the embassy vehicles, a plain, unmarked Ford. McKay, who knew the city like the back of his hand, had brought them in by a circuitous route that had avoided the known problem areas of the city. He pulled the Ford into a darkened alley, cut the motor, and they sat in the shadows until they were sure no one had seen them.
The main force of the Pro-Karima military are stationed at the front of the building. My source told me they only have a 3-man squad watching the rear in case the rebels try to sneak out. Sniper on the roof wounded 2 of their guys during the initial assault. Problem is, they don't have that larger force after spreading the rest across the city to monitor the rebels at the power station and TV studio. They have others on all the main approach roads in case the rebels try to bring in reinforcements. I mean, this country has a military force smaller than the National Guard in my hometown.
Consider that a bonus.
They checked their weapons. McKay carried a holstered M9 Beretta handgun and an M4 carbine. It was a short-barreled compact version of the M16A2 developed for the U.S. military. It was a handy weapon for close-quarter work. Bolin had his Desert Eagle and Beretta, plus an Uzi. Their hands and faces were layered with black camouflage paint, and both men wore black knitted woolen caps.
I'm with you.
McKay led them down the alley, bringing them to a deserted parking lot at the rear of the office block. Because of the power blackout, the security lights were off, leaving the parking lot in shadow. The only light was from the pale moon. They paused at the far corner, checking out the way ahead. McKay pointed in the direction they had to go and led the way to the next building, hugging the base of the wall. Bolin kept a check on their back trail, his Uzi cocked and ready for use if needed. McKay proved his knowledge of the city by leading Bolin around the silent buildings, easing into the bush that encroached on the back lots. If the vegetation wasn't cut back on a regular basis, the forest would have swallowed the buildings and returned to its natural state in a relatively short time. The heavy growth proved to be a godsend to Bolin and McKay, concealing their stealthy approach to the rear of Government House. Now they were getting closer, they resorted to using hand signals. It prevented any talk being overheard. McKay pointed out the position of the 3-man squad of Tempalan soldiers watching the rear wall of the garden area. Bolin acknowledged with a silent confirmation. The pair circled the Tempalan position and approached the walled garden along one of the side walls, out of sight of the Tempalan squad. They crouched in the heavy grass that grew in abundance along the base of the wall. The wall was around 9 feet high. Bolin slung his Uzi across his back, securing it to prevent it from swinging free and creating any sound. He signaled for McKay to give him a boost, and the Marine cupped his hands and raised the executioner until Bolin could stand briefly on McKay's shoulder. Bolin reached up and caught hold of the top edge of the wall, using his own strength to haul himself up so he could peer across the wall. The gardens were in near blackness. The moon had vanished behind a cloud for a period. Bolin studied the cloud formation and figured they had no more than a couple of minutes before pale light showed again. He scanned the roof profile of Government House. It was a flat affair with a raised parapet around the edges. He took his time checking out the parapet until he spotted the armed man with a long rifle. Bolin checked out the rifleman. He was resting both arms over the top of the parapet, and Bolin caught the glow of a cigarette in the man's mouth as he drew on it. Initial keenness at being given the task of watching for intruders had turned to semi-boredom. The long hours were showing. It was close to midnight, and the lone gunman would have started to wind down, his awareness dulled by his extended stint on the roof. Now was the time to make their move. Bolin pulled himself onto the top of the wall, keeping his eye on the distant sniper. The man showed no reaction, simply smoked his cigarette, and was most probably wishing he hadn't drawn that assignment. Stretched out along the wall, Bolin was rewarded by the sight of the figure pulling back from the parapet to raise his arms in a lazy stretch. The sniper stepped back, turning so that he was at an angle that had him looking away from Bolin's position. Bolin took the rope from around his waist and lowered it for McKay. The Marine grabbed it and climbed the wall quickly. He lay flat as Bolin hauled the rope back up. Together, they slid over the wall, hung by their hands, then dropped, barely making a sound as they landed in the cover of thick vegetation on the inside of the garden wall. Using the deep shadow at the base of the wall, combined with the bushes and trees, they closed in on the rear of the building. It was a concrete path that ran around the base of the walls. Evenly spaced, large clay pots that held masses of bright flowering plants were placed along this path. With Government House looming over them, Bolin and McKay crouched in the shadows of the surrounding bushes and assessed their next move. There was a substantial extension jutting out from the main building, situated midway along the rear wall. It had large windows and double doors that would be used to allow guests to step out into the gardens. The roof of this extension would provide handy access to the main roof of the building. Soft footsteps warned the Americans they weren't alone. They pulled back into the deeper shadows and watched an armed rebel moving in their general direction. The man carried an SA-80 rifle and walked with the measured tread of someone on sentry duty. He stopped short of the bushes, turning to make his return pass. The executioner made his move, reacting so quickly that McKay almost missed him easing from cover. Bolin's hand had already plucked out of a pocket the thin wire garrote he had brought with him. Stepping up behind the guard, Bolin looped the wire over the man's head, snapping tight against his throat and pulling the rebel to his knees. The man struggled in blind panic as the thin wire sliced into his flesh. He was unable to get a grip on the wire as blood began to surge from the deeply sliced flesh. His legs kicked out and his arms flailed, but he made no sound except a soft, wet gurgling as Bolin increased the pressure. A savage twist rolled the man on his side, Bolin placing a knee in his back to hold him down as he applied the final pressure that ended the struggle. As the guard slumped loose and still on the ground, Bolin freed the garrote and coiled it up, wiping his bloody hands down the legs of his fatigues. He caught hold of the guard's collar and dragged the body out of sight under the bushes, making sure he had the man's rifle. Bolin signaled McKay to join him, and they scanned the gardens, watching to see if there was another sentry. Time passed, and then a dark figure came into view on the far side of the smooth lawn. The newcomer patrolled in the same fashion as his now dead partner. Bolin allowed another couple of minutes to pass. No one else showed. The guard made his slow way to the far end of the garden, moving across to the side where Bolin and McKay waited. Eventually, he was going to miss the other guard and sound an alert. Bolin uncoiled the garrote and slid deeper into the bushes, working his way down the base of the wall until he was behind the patrolling sentry. McKay, who was watching the scene unfold, just caught a glimpse of the form that came out of the bushes. It was barely a sound until he heard the guard's choking gurgle as the thin wire in Bolin's hands flipped over the guard's head and sank into the soft flesh of his throat. The struggle was brief, ending when Bolin pulled the body into the bushes. Bolin rejoined McKay. He secured his Uzi, bringing it forward before indicating the building. The pair made their way to the extension. Bolin pointed at the sturdy downpipe coming from the guttering. He boosted McKay up and watched the Marine shinny up the pipe and roll out of sight on the flat roof. Bolin went after him, and they hugged the shadows, checking out the distance they would have to climb to reach the main roof. As they crouched there, listening, they heard the sound of the sniper moving back and forth on the other side of the parapet. McKay handed Bolin his M4.
I'll take this one. Cover me, Belasco.
McKay listened for the footfalls of the sniper. The man was muttering something into a transceiver. He seemed to be having words with whoever was on the other end of the conversation. Maybe the rebels were becoming restless. Nothing seemed to be happening, and they were getting into the late evening, a time when people started to get tired, even fractious. It meant they could be letting their guard down a little. On the negative side, it also made them dangerous, because a nervous hostage taker was a risk. Tired, fretful people did unexpected things if they thought nothing was happening. The sniper snapped something harsh into his transceiver, then moved to the parapet and banged the transceiver down. Still muttering to himself, he fumbled in his pocket for his pack of cigarettes and drew one out. He tried to light it, but the slight evening breeze blowing across the roof of the building snuffed the flame. The sniper turned his back to the breeze and hunched his shoulders, head down as he tried again. It was McKay's turn to move. The Marine rose to his full height and caught hold of the top edge of the parapet. He shoved off the extension, heaving himself up until he gained a foothold along the bottom. Without pause, he vaulted over the parapet, his soft-soled boots barely making a sound as he touched down on the other side. As he landed, he slid his sheathed knife free and moved in on the sniper, who started to turn, sensing a presence behind him. McKay's right hand slid around the sniper's head, knocking the cigarette from his lips as he clamped his hand over the sniper's mouth. McKay pulled the rebel in close and brought the knife around in a short, hard arc, sliding it under the sniper's ribs and into his heart. The rebel stiffened against the pain. The sniper turned and wriggled, trying to stay alive, but he was already on the downward slope, and McKay was able to lower the stilled body moments later. The Marine withdrew his knife and slipped it back into its sheath, then leaned over the parapet and clicked his fingers. Bolin joined him, handing back the man's M4.
The plans showed an access door.
Bolin indicated the location, and the pair loped across the flat roof. The door was slightly ajar, with stairs leading down into the building.
I'm banking on them having the hostages in Karima's office. That's where his direct phone line will be.
They'll most probably have someone manning the communication setup. I've been in here before. I know where it is. You want me to handle that?
Volunteering, Sergeant?
Hell yes.
McKay grinned. They descended the stairs and found another door at the bottom. Bolin eased the handle and the door opened without resistance. Bolin cracked it and peered through. He saw the passage he had walked along on his previous visit to Government House, with the doors to Karima's office at the far end. There was an armed rebel sitting on a chair beside the doors, his back partly toward Bolin.
Comm station is back the other way, near where the landing opens out for the main staircase.
Bolin peered around the edge of the door. As McKay had said, the wide landing lay 20 feet away. From where they were positioned, Bolin couldn't see anyone guarding it. He eased the Beretta from its shoulder rig and set it for single shot.
Subsonic cartridges and a suppressor. I'll deal with this guy. You head for the comm room. Once I go inside Karima's office, it's going to get noisy. When hell breaks loose, you make your play. And Glenn, stay lucky.
Surely you know the old Marine saying, you're not allowed to die unless it's ordered.
Bolin shook his head.
I never heard that one before.
I know, I just made it up. But it should be on the books.
Bolin pushed the door wide enough to allow them through. He turned in the direction of the rebel. McKay, his M4 ready in his hands, went in the opposite direction. He flattened against the wall as he heard voices coming from somewhere on the landing. Bolin had picked up the sound himself. He kept moving, closing the distance between himself and the rebel. The voices on the landing became louder. Someone laughed. The sound drew the rebel's attention, and he casually leaned back on his chair, his head turning to see who was laughing. He locked eyes with Bolin. He froze for a moment, then reached for his rifle leaning against the wall beside him. Bolin snapped the Beretta into position, gripping it two-handed, and shot the rebel between the eyes. The rebel's head snapped back, a glistening patch of blood and bone on the wall behind him. McKay heard the subdued chug of the Beretta and didn't bother to look back. He had the door to the comm room in sight, but he could also see shadows on the floor where the landing became the passage, and knew that any luck he and Bolin might have was about to run out. He plucked a stun grenade from his harness and clicked his fingers to alert Bolin. He showed the grenade to Bolin when the man glanced around. Bolin nodded, turning away, his hands already clamping over his ears. McKay popped the pin and rolled the grenade in the direction of the landing. He turned his back on it, head down, and covered his own ears. Seconds later, the grenade went off, the sharp crack and blinding flash of light filling the area. The incandescents hung around for what seemed an eternity. Bolin and McKay, protected from the effects by covering up, were only slightly dazed. It took them a few seconds to recover. After that, Government House erupted into bloody chaos. Bolin had a flash stun grenade in his hand as he booted open the door to Karima's office. He lobbed the grenade into the office, then pulled back against the outer wall, waiting for the blast. He saw the brilliant flash of light, heard the detonation through covered ears. As the sound faded and the glow receded, Bolin turned and ducked inside the room, scanning the interior to identify the occupants. He was met by an armed rebel. The hard man was blinking his watering eyes as he struggled to maintain his stance, the auto rifle in his hand swinging about wildly. The weapon began to fire, bullets peppering the walls behind Bolin. The executioner stayed low, his Uzi tracking the man. A short burst caught the rebel in the chest, knocking him off his feet. Bolin was already moving. He identified Leland Cartwright, bound to a chair, his face marked by a spread of ugly bruises. Behind him, an armed rebel was frantically rubbing his eyes with his free hand. Bolin took him out with a burst to the side of his head, spinning the rebel away from the ambassador. Joseph Karima sat at his desk, both hands cupping his face as he reacted to the effect of the flash stun grenade, and Raymond Nkoya was down on hands and knees, groping blindly around the floor. Bolin turned his attention to Haruri and Zimbala. The rebel leaders were at the far end of the room, backs to the door in deep conversation, and had escaped the bright white burn of the grenade's light, although the concussion had deafened them. They both turned as Bolin came into the room, hands dropping to the pistols on their hips. In the brief seconds it took Bolin to deal with the rebel standing over Leland Cartwright, Zimbala and Haruri cleared their weapons and turned them on the executioner. Out of the corner of his eye, Bolin saw the auto pistols. He took evasive action, throwing himself to the floor and rolling frantically, hearing the heavy sound of the handguns. Bullets pounded the polished wood floor around him. Keen splinters smacked against Bolin's clothing. He felt a solid blow to his upper left arm, and it started to go numb. The executioner knew he'd been hit. He slammed up against the front of Karima's large desk and cast the Uzi aside, snatching the Desert Eagle from its holster. His left arm had lost all its feeling now and dragged along the floor as he moved to a better position. Shimpi Haruri rushed around the far end of the desk. His face was twisted in pain from his deafened ears. Bolin fired the moment he saw Haruri's feet and legs, placing two 44 Magnum rounds into the rebel's right thigh. The bone shattered, the power of the slugs ripping away muscle and flesh. Blood began to pulse from the pulpy open wounds. Haruri fell, clutching the edge of the desk. As his upper body came into Bolin's target space, he fired a third shot that punched through Haruri's forehead and shredded his brain in a shower of mushrooming gore, blowing out the back of his skull. Glenn McKay had seen Bolin vanish inside Karima's office. He picked up the pace and moved along the passage until he rounded the corner that opened onto the wide landing. The shadows he had seen turned into the stunned figures of the two rebels. They were trying to shake off the disorientation caused by the flash stun grenade. McKay hit them with a burst from his M4. One went down on his back. The other staggered across the landing before toppling out of sight back down the stairs he had just climbed. By this time, McKay had crossed to the comm room door. He drove the door wide open with a hard boot, then stepped forward to face the room's occupants. There was the radio operator and an armed rebel. McKay hit the rifleman with a burst that sent a line of slugs into the man's upper chest. They knocked him off the chair he was straddling, sending him into the corner of the room. The rebel tried for the rifle he'd let go of. McKay hit him with another burst that stopped him completely. Turning the muzzle of the weapon on the radio man, McKay caught the rebel picking up a handgun he had beside him. The rebel swung the weapon around, firing a fraction too soon. The bullet passed between McKay's body and his left arm. Before the rebel could alter his aim, McKay triggered the M4 and put a pair of 5.56mm slugs into the rebel's chest. The impact shoved him back in his chair, and it rolled away from the desk, coming to rest against the far wall.
Son of a bitch!
McKay heard the sound of gunfire from the direction of Karima's office, then picked up the clatter of boots on the staircase. Company was on the way. McKay stepped out of the comm room and moved to the head of the staircase, meeting three rebels attracted by the shooting. He caught them midway up the stairs, raking the area with his M4. The rebels were caught in the open with nowhere to go and not a second left to react. McKay's burst punched through their chests and threw them down the stairs in a bloody tangle, weapons bouncing down the stone steps behind them. McKay positioned himself so he could see the base of the stairs and also keep an eye on the passage on the far side of the wide landing. With the bases covered, he had time to wonder how his partner was faring in Karima's office. Haruri was sprawled across the floor directly in front of Bolin, his body shuddering from the ravaging effects of the 44 Magnum rounds, his pistol slipping from his dead fingers. Bolin had already moved around to the far end of the desk and then to the rear. He heard a scurry of movement as well as a sound of protest from Karima.
Belasco, if that is your name, I have Karima. Do anything and I'll shoot him.
Leaning around the corner of the desk, Bolin saw Karima's legs and the seat he was sitting in. Glancing up, Bolin saw Zimbala, one arm across Karima's chest, his other hand wielding a pistol. The rebel leader was in the act of bringing the weapon down to press against Karima's head. Bolin had a couple of seconds to act. After that, it would start to get tricky. His one shot at Zimbala had to be accurate. The Desert Eagle rose in Bolin's steady right hand, tracked in on Zimbala, and blasted a .44 caliber bullet that struck the rebel leader in the side of the head. Zimbala stumbled back, his shocked expression wiped away when Bolin fired again, this time laying the magnum round in Zimbala's chest. The man turned under the impact, blood trailing from his shattered skull and chest, legs losing their coordination. He went down heavily, his pistol flying from slack fingers. It bounced as it hit the floor, spinning across the smooth surface. Bolin pulled himself erect, leaning against the edge of the desk, his left arm starting to give him pain. He could feel blood streaming down it, dripping from his fingers.
Sorry, Mr. President. I seem to be bleeding all over your floor.
Karima was staring at him through watering eyes, and Bolin realized the man couldn't hear him. There was the sound of boots moving along the passage. Bolin raised the Desert Eagle.
Velasco, you secure?
It was Glenn McKay.
All clear.
Bolin lowered the hand cannon. McKay stepped into the room, taking a swift survey of the situation.
You're clear.
Out there?
No problems, especially now the military just busted in through the front door.
The Marine grinned.
I guess we shook him up with all the shooting.
They could hear shouting and the clatter of boots on the stairs, then approaching the office. McKay crossed the office and used his knife to free Leland Cartwright.
Hey, Belasco, you okay?
McKay spotted Bolin's blood-soaked sleeve.
I will be, after I see that medic of yours back at the embassy.
Armed figures filled the office doorway. A young officer stepped forward, scanning the room, his face a classic example of total surprise and bewilderment.
I think an explanation is in order here. Can someone tell me what the hell is going on?
Captain?
McKay stepped forward. He offered a salute, which the officer returned.
You can let your people watching the rear know that the sniper has been taken down. We also dealt with a pair of armed rebels in the garden area. The communication room has been cleared, and President Karima, Vice President Nkoya, and Ambassador Cartwright have been removed from rebel hands, sir.
The captain, to his credit, maintained a professional manner. He turned to his men, crowding in behind him.
Sergeant, room-to-room search. Flush out any other rebels. Secure the building. Have our communications team take over the comm room and get signals to all our units. Inform them the president is safe and they can go ahead and retake rebel-held sites.
The captain turned back to survey the room. He took off his peaked cap and ran a hand through his close-cropped hair. For the first time, he noticed Bolin, who was standing quietly to one side.
Who are you?
Joseph Karima spoke. Still smarting from the effects of the flash stun grenade, he had recovered enough to intervene.
Captain, he's with me.
He glanced at Bolin.
Do you have more good news for me, Mr. Belasco?
Bolin nodded.
They're both waiting for you at the embassy. Probably sleeping by now.
I owe you a debt I can never repay.
Seeing those kids back with you will be enough.
Leland Cartwright stood up.
Time we got this boy back to the embassy. In case nobody noticed, he caught a bullet. Captain, see to it. Mr. Belasco, we will talk later. It seems I have a country to get back on the tracks.
If anyone can do it, Mr. President, you can.
U.S. Embassy, 3 days later.
When are you coming home?
The clarity of the connection via the embassy communications placed Brugnola in the room where Bolin was sitting.
Couple more days. Karima has things in hand pretty well now. Have to hand it to the guy. It's like he's undergone a transformation. Nearly losing everything, especially his kids, has given him an edge. And the country is behind him. Rebel opposition has crumbled heavily. The ones who haven't quit took off for the backcountry. Karima's going to have to deal with them sooner or later, but I think he'll come through.
Losing Chakra seems to have taken the spirit out of the rebel movement. Information we're getting says the military is in a state of shock, finding out he was working against the government.
Karima has taken over Chakra's role until he can find a replacement. He's coming down hard on the people who were siding with the rebels. Cleaning house has rooted out most of the rebel sympathizers.
Cartwright is back on track with his negotiations, I hear.
That guy is unstoppable. He was back at the conference table the next day.
From what I heard from the man, Cartwright is now a big fan of yours. Apparently you impressed him, and Leland Cartwright is not easily impressed.
Bolin didn't make any comment.
Well, by the way, the president sends his thanks. I also reminded him he owes us one for this.
I hear one of the concessions Karima wants from the Navy is a couple of Coast Guard cutters so he can set up surveillance on these slave traders.
Like you said, Stryker, Karima is determined to make things work out there. Did his teams locate all the people you hauled off that ship?
They found them. They're working on getting them all back home.
How's the arm doing?
Mending nicely. I was lucky, Hal. Luckier than some.
Bolin was thinking about Christopher Jomo and Chembi. The image of the boy, cold and alone in death, would become one of the ghosts that reached out of the darkness to remind Bolin why he continued his everlasting war. Sometimes it had nothing to do with large-scale threats or the twisted plans of evil men. There were occasions when it had to do with the death of a single, innocent child. And that was more than enough to keep him moving along that extra mile. The Executioner Shadow Search is a Graphic Audio production. Mac Bolan and The Executioner are trademarks owned by Harlequin Enterprises Limited, used by others under license. Copyright 2004, Worldwide Library, all rights reserved. Production copyright 2004, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terence Acil Ford, Nanette Savard, and Thomas Penny. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers and Chris Rowan. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. If you enjoyed The Executioner, be sure to look for Don Pendleton's Mac Bolan and Stony Man, available at Road Stops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.